It's February 2000. A sock puppet, a literal sock puppet with googly eyes, is the most recognized advertising mascot in America. It's appeared on Good Morning America, at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and in a Super Bowl commercial that cost $1.2 million. The company behind the sock puppet, Pets.com, has annual revenue of $619,000. It's just raised $82.5 million in an initial public offering.
In the audience at the IPO celebration, there are investment bankers clinking champagne glasses. There are founders in khakis grinning at each other. There are journalists writing stories about the democratization of pet supplies. Nobody in the room is doing the math, because the math says that Pets.com loses money on every single order. The more customers the sock puppet acquires, the faster the company dies.
268 days later, Pets.com is liquidated. The sock puppet's intellectual property is sold at auction for a fraction of what the Super Bowl ad cost. The era of irrational exuberance has collided with the immovable object of unit economics.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlyle. This is Episode 7. So a sock puppet with googly eyes, an $82 million IPO, and a company that lost money on every order it ever shipped. That's the dot-com era in one sentence.
And today we're doing the dot-com bubble, which I think is one of the most important episodes we'll ever do, because the lessons from 1999 and 2000 are the lessons that every investor, every founder, and every operator needs to understand before they can navigate any hype cycle.
I agree, and I want to frame this up front. The story of the dot-com bubble isn't a story about technology failing. The technology worked, the internet was real, e-commerce was real. The story is about the difference between a real technology and a viable business, and about what happens when capital markets lose the ability to distinguish between the two.
Before we dive in, trivia, and this one is about the scale of the mania. Listeners, here's the question. How many companies went public in the United States in 1999, and what happened to most of them within 2 years?
This number is genuinely staggering.
If you're playing along, pause now. The answer, 457 IPOs in 1999. 457 companies went public in a single year. For context, in a normal year, the number is somewhere between 100 and 200. In 2001, 2 years later, the number dropped to fewer than 20. And the vast majority of those 457 companies, they went to zero. Not underperformed. Not lost value. Zero. Liquidated. Acquired for pennies. Delisted.
457. I want to sit with that number. That's more than one IPO per business day. The market was minting public companies faster than a person could read the prospectuses. And the capital markets, the investment banks, the institutional investors, the retail buyers, were absorbing all of them. Not because the businesses were sound, because the momentum was irresistible.
And here's the thing that connects this to the broader arc of our series. We just spent two episodes on Apple, a company drowning in genuine competitive advantages. And now we're entering an era where the capital markets couldn't distinguish Apple-level strategy from a sock puppet selling kibble at a loss. That's terrifying.
It should make every investor in every era uncomfortable. Because if it happened then, it can happen now.
Let's set the context. What does the world look like during the run-up to the bubble?
Start with Netscape. August 9, 1995. Netscape Communications goes public. The company makes a web browser. It has no profits. It has minimal revenue. It prices at $28 a share and opens at $71. By the end of the day, the company is valued at $2.9 billion. Mark Andreessen is on the cover of Time magazine, barefoot, sitting in a golden throne.
Put yourself in the shoes of every entrepreneur in Silicon Valley watching that IPO. A company with no profits just became worth $3 billion in a single day. The message is clear. The market is willing to pay enormous prices for internet companies, and profitability is not a requirement.
And this creates a self-reinforcing loop. Entrepreneurs start internet companies because VCs will fund them. VCs fund them because investment banks will take them public. Investment banks take them public because retail investors will buy the shares. Retail investors buy the shares because the stocks go up. The stocks go up because more retail investors buy them. Nobody in this chain is evaluating the fundamental economics of the businesses. They're evaluating momentum.
And here's the thing. This is the Fairchild equity lesson from episode one, but inverted. At Fairchild, the engineers created enormous value and captured none of it. In the dot-com bubble, founders captured enormous value while creating none of it. Both are market failures, just in opposite directions.
That's a sharp observation. And the intellectual justification for all of it, and there was one, was the eyeballs before revenue doctrine. The theory was, the internet is a winner-take-all market. If you can acquire the most users, you'll be the dominant platform and you can figure out monetization later. Get big fast. Worry about profits never.
And this wasn't crazy as a theory. Network effects are real. First mover advantage in network businesses is real. Amazon did get big fast and figured out profitability later. The problem wasn't the theory. The problem was the indiscriminate application of the theory to every company with a .com in its name, regardless of whether the company had any plausible path to positive unit economics at any scale.
The NASDAQ rises over 500% between 1995 and March 2000, from roughly 750 to 5,048. Individual stocks are doubling, tripling, quintupling in weeks. Day trading becomes a national hobby. People are quitting their jobs to trade internet stocks from their living rooms.
Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, coins the phrase irrational exuberance in December 1996. He asks in a speech, "How do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values?" The market dips for one day after this speech and then resumes climbing for three more years. The NASDAQ more than triples between Greenspan's warning and the peak.
The man who identified the bubble couldn't pop it by naming it.
Which tells you something about the nature of manias. Identifying them intellectually doesn't protect you from them economically. Everyone in the market knew Greenspan had said it. Everyone agreed in principle that asset prices might be inflated. And everyone continued buying because the guy next to them was continuing to buy, and missing out felt more dangerous than being right too early. Let's talk about the companies that became the symbols of the bubble. Because understanding why they failed is the key to understanding why a few others survived.
Start with Pets.com, which we mentioned in the cold open. Founded 1998, the premise, sell pet supplies online. The pitch, the pet supply market is large, fragmented, and dominated by local stores with limited selection. An online retailer can offer better selection, lower prices, and home delivery.
And the pitch isn't wrong. 20 years later, Chewy.com would prove that the online pet supply model works. But Chewy succeeded because it had positive unit economics. It priced products with margin, it optimized shipping costs, it built a subscription model for repeat purchases. Pets.com had none of these things.
Well, let me give you the number that captures the insanity. Pets.com's sock puppet mascot, the production cost of creating and promoting that mascot, including the Super Bowl ad, cost more to produce than the company's entire first quarter of revenue.
I'm sorry, the mascot cost more than the revenue.
The Super Bowl ad alone was $1.2 million. First quarter revenue was a fraction of that. They spent more money on a puppet with googly eyes than the total amount of money customers gave them for pet food. That's not a business. That's a fever dream with a marketing budget.
And the structural problem was even worse than the marketing spend. Pets.com was selling heavy, bulky, low-margin items, dog food, cat litter, bags of kibble, at prices that were at or below their own cost. On top of that, they were offering free shipping on orders over a low threshold, and they were subsidizing shipping on orders under $25. The cost of shipping a 30-pound bag of dog food exceeded the margin on the product itself. So every customer who bought what Pets.com was designed to sell cost the company money. Not because of overhead or marketing or technology costs. At the unit level, revenue per order was less than cost per order.
And the sock puppet, the mascot, was such a successful piece of marketing that it actually made the problem worse. It drove more customers to a store that lost money on every customer it served. Marketing so effective, it accelerated bankruptcy.
That should be framed on the wall of every growth team in Silicon Valley.
Right next to the unit economics spreadsheet.
Now, Webvan. If Pets.com is the comedy, Webvan is the tragedy. Founded 1996 by Lewis Borders, yes, from the Borders bookstore family, the premise, online grocery delivery. Order groceries on the web, we deliver them to your door within a 30-minute window.
And again, the idea isn't wrong. Instacart, Amazon Fresh, Walmart Grocery, 20 years later, online grocery delivery is a real business. But Webvan made a catastrophic strategic error that I think is the single most instructive failure in the history of startups.
Go.
Webvan built automated distribution centers in 8 cities before proving the model worked in 1. Let me say that again. 8 cities. Automated warehouses, robotic fulfillment systems. They contracted for roughly $1 billion in infrastructure for 26 planned metropolitan markets. They signed these contracts before demonstrating that customers would order frequently enough, that delivery costs could be reduced to sustainable levels, that the average order size justified the logistics expense. They bet $1 billion on infrastructure for a business model that hadn't been validated at any scale.
I need people to absorb that. Not, they expanded too fast. They built automated warehouses in 8 cities before proving the model worked in 1. That's not aggressive growth. That's building a skyscraper before testing whether the foundation can hold a single floor.
And the leadership team wasn't stupid. Lewis Borders was an experienced entrepreneur. The board included former Anderson Consulting Partners, the management consultancy that later became Accenture. Goldman Sachs led the IPO. These were sophisticated people, but they were operating in an environment where the cost of capital was approximately 0 and the market rewarded ambition over validation. In that environment, building warehouses in 8 cities before proving one felt like boldness, not recklessness.
Webvan burned through $830 million and shut down in July 2001. At the time of closure, it was delivering groceries in 2 markets. 24 of the 26 planned markets never launched. The distribution centers were sold for pennies on the dollar.
I mean, $830 million, gone. And here's what haunts me about this. Instacart is worth billions today, doing essentially the same thing Webvan tried to do. The idea was right, the timing was wrong, the execution strategy was wrong, and $830 million was the tuition for that lesson.
The most expensive class in the history of business school.
And here's the analytically important part. Compare Webvan's approach to how Instacart built the same business. Instacart didn't build warehouses. It used existing grocery stores as inventory. It didn't hire full-time delivery drivers. It used gig workers. It didn't expand to 26 cities simultaneously. It proved the model in 1 city, then 2, then 10. Every step was funded by the unit economics of the previous step. Webvan spent $1 billion on infrastructure before generating meaningful revenue. Instacart generated revenue before spending meaningfully on infrastructure. Same idea. Opposite execution, opposite outcomes.
The billion-dollar lesson is, prove it works in 1 city before you build it in 8. On March 10, 2000, the NASDAQ Composite Index closes at 5,048. This is the peak. Nobody knows it's the peak on that day. That only becomes clear in retrospect. But starting the following week, the index begins to decline.
The proximate triggers are debatable. Some point to the failure of the AOL-Time Warner merger announcement to sustain market enthusiasm. Some point to a Barron's cover story that calculated the burn rates of major internet companies and projected when they'd run out of cash. Some point to the Fed raising interest rates. Probably it was all of these and none of them. Manias don't end because of a single catalyst. They end because the collective belief that sustains them develops a crack, and once the crack forms, it spreads.
The decline isn't immediate. In March and April 2000, there are rallies. People buy the dip. The phrase, "this is a buying opportunity," appears in every financial publication, but the dip keeps dipping.
By April 2000, the NASDAQ has fallen to about 3,300. By December 2000, it's below 2,500. By October 2002, it reaches 1,114. That's a 78% decline from the peak. If you'd invested $1 million at the NASDAQ peak, 2.5 years later you had $220,000.
And many individual stocks fared far worse. Cisco fell 90%, Intel fell 80%, Amazon fell 94% from $107 to $7.
Let me stay on that Amazon number. 94%. From 107 to 7. Analysts were predicting bankruptcy. The New York Post ran a cover with the headline Amazon.bomb. Lehman Brothers published a report titled Amazon.toast. Everyone, the press, the analysts, the market, had written Amazon's obituary.
And Jeff Bezos was building distribution centers.
While the stock was falling 94% and analysts were predicting his company's death, Bezos was investing in the logistics infrastructure that would become the most formidable fulfillment network in the history of commerce. He wasn't doing PR. He wasn't defending the stock price. He was building the machine.
Put yourself in the shoes of someone who quit their accounting job in 1999 to day trade internet stocks. By 2002, their portfolio is worth a fifth of what it was. The retirement savings they put into Cisco are down 90%. The stock options from their dot-com startup are worthless. The career they left doesn't want them back. This isn't an abstraction. This happened to millions of people.
And the venture capital industry nearly collapsed. VC funds that had raised billions in 1999 and 2000 had portfolios of companies that couldn't raise follow-on funding, couldn't go public, and couldn't generate revenue fast enough to survive. The number of VC-backed IPOs went from 457 in 1999 to fewer than 20 in 2001. From 457 to 20, that's a 96% drop.
The companies that died in the crash, Pets.com, Webvan, Cosmo.com, eToys, Boo.com, DrCoop.com, they went to zero. And billions of dollars in combined investment, some of the most well-funded product efforts in the history of technology. Just gone.
Here's the part of the story that matters most for this course. Not every internet company died. Some survived the crash and went on to become the most valuable companies in the world. The question is, what separated the survivors from the casualties?
Amazon survived, Google survived, eBay survived, PayPal survived, Priceline survived. What did they have in common?
The sorting mechanism is brutally simple once you see it. Let me walk through it.
Go.
Characteristic 1, actual repeat purchase behavior. Amazon's customers came back. They bought books, then they bought electronics, then they bought everything. The customer wasn't a one-time visitor driven by a marketing campaign. The customer had a genuine reason to return. eBay's buyers and sellers returned because the marketplace had liquidity. They could actually buy and sell things. Google's users returned because the search results were better than the alternatives. In every case, the product generated organic repeat usage.
Versus Pets.com, where nobody was going to develop a loyal relationship with an online pet store that charged the same prices as PetSmart but took 3 days to deliver a bag of kibble.
Characteristic 2, unit economics that were positive or plausibly positive at scale. Amazon's per-unit cost of shipping a book decreased as volume increased because it could negotiate better carrier rates, build more efficient distribution centers, and amortize fixed costs over more orders. Google's cost per search decreased as volume increased because the infrastructure was a fixed cost and each incremental search was nearly free. These were businesses where growth made the economics better.
And the key word is plausibly. Amazon wasn't profitable in 2000. It was losing money. But if you did the analysis, and Jeff Bezos laid this out explicitly in his shareholder letters, you could model a path to profitability that was credible. The losses were driven by investment in infrastructure that would generate returns at scale. The per-unit economics were trending in the right direction. That's fundamentally different from Pets.com, where no amount of scale would fix the problem of shipping heavy items at below cost.
Characteristic 3, infrastructure investments that created real moats. Amazon was building distribution centers, logistics networks, technology platforms. These were expensive, but they were also durable competitive advantages that would take competitors years and billions of dollars to replicate. Google was building the world's largest computing infrastructure, indexing the entire internet, accumulating a data advantage that compounded with every search query. eBay had built a two-sided marketplace with genuine liquidity that a new entrant couldn't replicate without simultaneously attracting millions of buyers and sellers.
The survivors invested in things that got more valuable over time. The casualties invested in things that got consumed: marketing campaigns, Super Bowl ads, sock puppets.
The infrastructure compounded. The puppet didn't.
I'm putting that on a t-shirt.
And here's the number that proves the sorting mechanism worked. If you run the math on the NASDAQ from 2002 to 2020, the survivors, Amazon, Google, eBay, PayPal, Priceline, returned over 10,000% from their post-crash lows. The technology wasn't wrong. The businesses weren't all wrong. The pricing was wrong. And the crash repriced everything based on fundamental economics rather than momentum.
Which means the investors who bought Amazon at $7 in 2001, understanding that the unit economics were sound and the infrastructure was real, made the best investment of the decade. The crash didn't destroy value, it redistributed it from momentum investors to fundamental investors.
I want to let that sink in, because the conventional narrative is that the dot-com crash destroyed trillions of dollars. It didn't. It transferred trillions of dollars from people who were wrong about which companies had real economics to people who were right. The wealth didn't disappear. It moved.
And it moved to the patient, which, as we'll see in the Amazon episode, is basically the entire Bezos thesis. And if you want to train yourself to spot the difference between real economics and hype, to be on the right side of the next crash, the online course at svstrategy.xyz has mystery company simulations where you evaluate actual business models and make investment decisions without knowing the company name. It's the best way to build this muscle. That's SV, short for Silicon Valley, strategy.xyz.
SVstrategy.exyz, the unit economics filter in interactive form. Three frameworks from the dot-com story. And honestly, these might be the most practically useful frameworks in the entire course.
Go.
Framework 1. Unit economics as the fundamental filter. The question that sorts winners from losers isn't, is the market large, or is the technology real, or are users growing? It's, does each incremental customer make the business more profitable or less profitable? If the answer is more profitable, if customer acquisition cost is less than lifetime value, if marginal cost decreases with volume, if repeat purchase rates increase over time, then growth is an asset. If the answer is less profitable, if each customer costs more to serve than they generate in revenue, then growth is a liability. Growth at negative unit economics means you're going bankrupt faster. And in 1999, the market assumed that growth was always good. It treated user acquisition as inherently valuable regardless of the economics behind each user. A million users at negative unit economics isn't an asset, it's a million individual sources of cash destruction.
And the way you apply this filter is brutally simple. Take the company's revenue per customer and subtract the fully loaded cost of serving that customer. If the number is positive and trending up, you have a real business. If it's negative at every scale, you have a pets.com. The market in 1999 wasn't running this calculation. Or rather, it was running it and choosing to ignore the result.
Framework 2, growth versus leverage. I want to define these precisely because the confusion between them is what creates bubbles. Growth means acquiring more customers at positive unit economics. Each new customer adds profit. The business gets stronger as it gets bigger. Growth is what Amazon was doing, building infrastructure that reduced per unit costs, adding customers who came back, improving economics with scale. Leverage means acquiring more customers at negative unit economics, funded by external capital. Each new customer adds loss. The business gets weaker but larger. The capital markets see larger and interpret it as stronger, but the underlying economics are deteriorating with every customer added.
And I want to push back on one thing, because this is the hardest question in investing. Is it always clear in real time whether a company is growing or levered? Because Amazon was losing money too. Bezos was reinvesting everything. How do you tell the difference between Amazon's invest for growth and Webvan's burn cash until bankruptcy?
That's the right question, and the honest answer is it's not always clear. But there are signals. Amazon's losses were driven by infrastructure investment, distribution centers, technology, systems that would reduce per-unit costs at scale. The per-unit economics were improving quarter over quarter. Webvan's losses were driven by operational costs that scaled linearly with volume. The per-unit economics were not improving. The signal is, are the unit economics trending toward positive, or are they stuck? If they're trending, you might have a growth investment. If they're stuck or getting worse, you have leverage.
Framework 3, the survivor's checklist. This is our synthesis of what the companies that survived the crash had in common, and I think it works as a diagnostic for any hype cycle. 1. Does the product generate organic repeat usage without paid marketing? 2. Do unit economics improve with scale or deteriorate? 3. Is the company building durable infrastructure or spending on ephemeral attention? 4. Can you model a credible path to profitability, even if it's years away? If the answers are yes, yes, durable, and yes, you might have a survivor. If any answer is no, you have a candidate for the crash.
And in March 2000, the market valued companies that passed all four tests the same as companies that failed all four. That's the mania, the inability to distinguish. And the crash is the correction, the violent, painful process by which the market relearns how to tell the difference.
What do you take from this if you're running a company? Not investing in one, running one.
First, know your unit economics before you scale. This sounds obvious, and it is obvious, and in every hype cycle it gets forgotten. Before you raise $100 million to expand nationally, prove that your model works in one city. Prove that customer acquisition cost is less than customer lifetime value. Prove that marginal cost decreases with volume. If you can't prove these things in one market, adding 25 more markets doesn't help. It multiplies the failure. Webvan is the eternal monument to this lesson. 8 cities, $1 billion, sold for pennies.
Second, ignore the competitive pressure to scale at negative unit economics. In a mania, every company in your space is raising money and expanding. The fear is, if you don't match their pace, they'll win the market and you'll be too late. But winning the market at negative unit economics isn't winning. It's losing faster than the competition. The company that survives the crash is the one that has the economics to survive without external capital. And the crash always comes.
And there's a version of this that applies to the current moment. Not to name names, but there are AI companies right now that are scaling aggressively, burning enormous amounts of capital on the theory that whoever achieves scale first wins the market. And the dot-com lesson is, maybe. But only if the unit economics work at scale. If they don't, being first to scale means being first to zero.
And for anyone listening who thinks this time is different, those are historically the four most expensive words in investing.
Right up there with, we'll figure out the economics at scale.
Let's land this. Takeaways from the dot-com bubble.
Number one, real technology doesn't imply viable business. The internet was real. E-commerce was real. Online grocery delivery was real. The technology worked. But a working technology and a working business are different things, and the gap between them is measured in unit economics. Every hype cycle starts with a genuine technological breakthrough and produces a mania that conflates the technology works with every company using the technology will succeed. The survivors are the ones who bridge the gap. The casualties are the ones who assume the gap doesn't exist.
Number two. Growth at negative unit economics isn't growth, it's leverage. And leverage kills. The single most dangerous sentence in a startup board meeting is, we'll figure out the economics at scale. If the unit economics don't work at your current scale, they probably don't work at any scale. And if they do work at scale, prove it, model it, show the mechanism by which costs decrease and margins improve. Assertion isn't evidence. And the dot-com graveyard is filled with companies whose boards accepted assertion instead of evidence.
Number three, the survivors of every bubble are the companies that invested in durable infrastructure rather than temporary attention. Amazon built distribution centers. Google built search infrastructure. eBay built a marketplace with real liquidity. Pets.com built a sock puppet. Webvan built warehouses in 8 cities before proving the model in one. The infrastructure compounded, the puppet didn't. And the warehouses, built before the economics were proven, became the most expensive scrap metal in history.
Number four, in a mania, the market can't distinguish between companies with multiple compounding competitive advantages and companies with zero. Amazon had scale economies in logistics, switching costs in purchase history, counterpositioning with a negative working capital model that traditional retail couldn't copy. Google had scale economies in search infrastructure, network economies in its advertiser network, a cornered resource in its accumulating data. Pets.com had zero. eBay had network economies from marketplace liquidity. Webvan had zero. In March 2000, the market valued companies with four compounding powers the same as companies with zero powers. In October 2002, it didn't. Your job, as a founder, as an investor, as an operator, is to be able to tell the difference before the market forces you to.
And number five, this is the one I keep coming back to. The crash didn't destroy value. It redistributed it. The wealth moved from momentum investors to fundamental investors, from people who were buying because the stock was going up to people who were buying because the business was sound. The total value created by the internet didn't change. The distribution of who captured that value changed dramatically, and the people who captured it were the patient ones. The ones who could look at Amazon at $7 a share and see distribution centers instead of a stock chart.
And that's the most important sentence in this episode. Patience backed by unit economics is the most reliable strategy in any market.
Through lines. Through line five, unit economics is destiny. Every company that died in the crash had negative unit economics. Everyone that survived had a path to positive. And through line three, the internet was a platform shift. The survivors understood that. The casualties thought it was a marketing channel. Before we go, the online course at svstrategy.exyz covers the dot-com era with a framework for evaluating hype cycles that you can apply to AI, crypto, or whatever comes next, plus quizzes and the era context that puts you inside 1999 as an investor deciding what's real and what's not. That's svstrategy.exyz.
svstrategy.exyz. Next time, Google. The company that emerged from the wreckage with a business model that was, in retrospect, the most important innovation of the entire internet era.
Intent-based advertising. The invention that paid for everything.
See you next time.